Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Rachel Erskine. Rachel has been working in the international solidarity sector for more than 12 years, five of them as communications lead for the UK branch of Nairobi-based public health NGO AMREF Health Africa. Rachel strongly believes that the INGO sector must take responsibility for the harm it has caused through decades of partial and paternalistic, even if well-intentioned, storytelling. She believes that it's time to shift the dynamics of fundraising content production, creating opportunities for the people we support to tell their own stories. Now, as a freelancer, she's currently working for AMREF's global fundraising office. She regularly speaks and writes on the topic of ethical storytelling and co-chairs BONDS, People in the Pictures Working Group, which encourages ethical approaches to image making among INGOs. Rachel, I'm really excited to have you on Tolerable Risk today. We are going to talk about ethical storytelling, which I saw you post about a little bit ago, and I was fascinated by the topic and the thinking around it. And so I'm really glad that you agreed to come on the show and talk to me and let other people listen in. So welcome to Tolerable Risk.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
So for people who aren't familiar with you or the work that you've done or your background in the third sector, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the work that you do in charities and nonprofits?
Sure. So I've been working in the international solidarity sector for about 12 or 13 years now. Five of those as the comms lead for the UK branch of AMREF Health Africa, which is a Nairobi-based public health NGO. I have a particular interest, as you said, in the ethics of INGO communications and fundraising, which is something I was able to nurture at AMREF. I now work as a consultant, don't we all? And I'm mainly working on a project for AMREF, which aims to incorporate our commitment to ethical storytelling into our global fundraising brand. But I have a few other clients too. I also co-chair the People in the Pictures Working Group, which is hosted by BOND here in the UK. And through that, I'm privy to a lot of exciting work that's going on where INGOs, big and small, are making bold commitments and showing what's possible when it comes to ethical storytelling. So I guess, like a lot of people, when I was younger and starting out in my career, I didn't really ever imagine myself doing this. I guess I didn't think it was a job, and it probably wasn't back then. I think things have evolved quite quickly, and probably not as quickly as they ought to. But yeah, I started out working for a French NGO. I was living in Paris after I graduated from university. And my first job in the sector was filling in other people's visa application, which remains probably the most stressful job I've ever had. You know what it's like, and you're sort of at the bottom of the chain. But if you don't get your job right, then the repercussions are quite significant. So yeah, I think that was a really good place to start. And since then, my work has evolved, and it's always been quite kind of people-centric, I guess. And I landed in communications, which, as someone who is naturally very kind of nosy and interested in people and what motivates them, it's a great place to be. And it's particularly exciting, I would say, at the moment because of all the work that's going on around the ethics of our communication and fundraising.
You and I can both share war stories about working for French NGOs, but we won't do that on the episode today. Maybe we'll do that on a future episode.
We'll spare the
So yeah, let's jump into ethical storytelling and the ethics around communications, because that has been something that people have been talking a lot about for a while now. I mean, I remember when I first got into the sector, there was this phrase called poverty porn, right? And it was the fundraising emails or posters that you saw with very skinny children, flies in their eyes, quite motivating and hard-hitting. But there was this thinking around it that these people, these human beings, were being turned into objects and they weren't really being respectfully portrayed or shown. So when we talk about ethical storytelling or ethical communications, what do people get wrong? What is some concept or theme of this area that people think about mistakenly or are confused about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So maybe I'll start by just giving you a bit of an overview of what I understand by ethical communication. I think you could define and approach it in a lot of different ways, but for me, it's about exactly what you were talking about, the sector coming to terms with the damage we've done over decades by portraying particular people, individuals and groups of people and parts of the world in a very sort of narrow and paternalistic way. And as a result, we've contributed to these very stubborn stereotypes about places and people that we are now finding are having repercussions in the real world. So when it comes to ethical communications, for me, it's all about how we represent the people we work with, and also importantly, how much control they have, not just over how their stories are told, but what those stories are. So it's all about examining and unpacking the power dynamics and the assumptions that underlie the images and words we use, and opening up our editorial processes to make them more collaborative so that people have choice. So it's really all about consent and about respecting the rights, the agency, and the preferences of the people who share our stories with us. Because if they didn't do that so generously, then we couldn't do our jobs. So I think in terms of what people get wrong, two things. First of all, I would say they think ethical communications and communications more generally is unrelated to the rest of our work, that it sits apart. But for me, it's not peripheral, it's integral. Often communications is treated as being of secondary importance. You know what it's like? It's always the comms line that's first to get cut from a budget. And it's often one of those things that you only realize it was going well when it goes wrong. But for me, there's a very clear link between ethical communication and our broader mandates as social justice organizations and the kind of promises we make to the people and communities we serve. And secondly, I think it's easy for people to feel overwhelmed. And when we start talking about ethical storytelling, they feel they're being expected to revolutionize all of their calls and fundraising, all their channels and all their audiences, the way they've been doing things for decades and the way that's kind of been proven to work according to a certain set of criteria. And I think that is ultimately what we need to do. But I'm also quite pragmatic. I think it can help to start with one very small and tangible thing and kind of work out from there. And I was listening to your recent episode on data protection in marketing and fundraising. And actually, I think there are quite a lot of parallels with GDPR if you think about it. So this whole idea that an absence of opting out is not equal to an opt-in, and asking yourself, are you really giving people choice? Are they consenting freely and fully? And are they able to change their minds?
I like your point about power dynamics and how this is really about consent and respect, because for such a long time, and now we're talking a lot about decolonization of aid, localization, right? Engaging the beneficiaries and participants in the programming that's being designed in order to help support these communities that are in need or are in crisis. And really looking at it, using those ways of thinking about power, about consent, and about respect, I think are great themes for us to keep in mind as we talk throughout this episode. And yeah, the comms line, along with the training line, I think are usually the ones that are the first to get cut out of a budget. And then let's go on to this point where you're saying that organizations feel like they have to just completely reinvent communications, because I think that's probably pretty common. Along with some of the conversations I've had with people about diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Organizations can come to that knowing that it's the right thing to do and it's the space that they need to be in, but maybe they're really overwhelmed. They're scared. They don't want to put the wrong foot forward. Their intentions are good, but they really don't know where to begin, and they're worried about bollocksing it up and making it even worse. So when you've been working with some of these organizations, and you were saying making some small changes at first, what are some things that these organizations can do to, number one, identify if they are engaging in ethical communication and ethical storytelling? And if they find that there's areas for improvement, what are some things that they can do?
Yeah, great question. I think that's really helpful to use that lens of power to frame this work. So it's about looking at, as you said, not just the end product, but also the process that we go through to create that product. So our whole content life cycle, from commissioning creative content, gathering it, doing the post-production, and then sort of feeding back to the people who feature. So the idea of circularity, I think, is really important. And I would say that ethical communications is kind of an emerging area of expertise, but it's gaining traction quite quickly. And I would say it's often, as you pointed out, kind of experienced as a constraint. There is a fear that we won't be able to continue raising funds the way we've been doing for decades. And I would say maybe that's a good thing. My experience has been that taking a kind of thoughtful and people-centered and power-conscious approach to storytelling often actually results in stories that are equally, if not more powerful, stories that can surprise you and move you in different ways and provoke different emotions. And that actually can feel quite liberating, and it's quite exciting if you are in the line of work that I am. It opens up all these creative possibilities that we hadn't even imagined. In terms of where to start, my biggest piece of advice would be to ask. I think it's easy to overlook, but sometimes we get very much up in our own heads about these things. And the most useful thing you can do is ask the people in the pictures how they feel. There's a really interesting piece of work that Save the Children did back in 2017, authored by Jeff Crombie and Siobhan Warrington, called people in the pictures, and they interviewed people who were featured in Save the Children's fundraising columns in four different contexts, four different countries. And they asked them about their experience, not just to sort of look at the end result and how they were depicted in context in the final product, but also how the process had been for them. And I think sometimes we forget that very simple tool that is available to us, which is in the same way that we do in our program work, asking people for feedback and listening and being willing to hear that we've not got things right. And I think that accountability piece is really important. But then the other thing that as NGOs we have is we have access to our supporters too. And I think it's worth asking them what they'd like to see from us. So one thing I've experienced at AMREF and elsewhere is that this commitment we've made to ethical storytelling has actually been a really exciting opportunity for engagement with our audiences. Not only have they reacted to fundraising campaigns that have been more people-centered and participatory by making gifts, but they've also been really proud to be associated with an organization that kind of has the courage of its convictions. One thing that for me has been really helpful is to start with your consent policy, having a look at your policy and any associated tools and practices and reviewing them through the lens of power. So just making sure that you truly are giving people the opportunity to fully understand what it is they are consenting to, because it's very easy to be happy with having your picture taken. But then when you see the end product, you see your picture, you think, oh, it's really not my best angle. Or when you see, you know, the caption that accompanies it, you might feel quite different about it. It might no longer feel representative or authentic. So reviewing the consent process, making it more accessible as well, making sure that for people who maybe don't write and read easily, that you've got options for them. So considering having a consent form that has pictographs, or not even a form perhaps, but giving the option of recording. And there are lots of apps out there. Just thinking about what people need, I suppose, to fully understand what it is they're agreeing to know what the consequences are. Because especially when we're publishing stuff online, we really can't guarantee where things are going to end up and who's going to see them and what the potential real life consequences will be. And I think it's really important that people are given the opportunity to understand that. And another thing that's key is that idea of circularity. So when possible, and I know it's not always easy logistically, giving people the opportunity to see and approve of the end product before it goes out, and maybe having a hard copy of the pictures you've taken, and making sure that if they have any doubts or they change their minds, even a couple of months or years down the line, that they're able to contact you and let you know, and that you have a process in place and that you know what to do when that happens, so that you can retire a particular image or piece of content from use to the extent that it's possible. And I think another thing that's key is putting a lifespan on that consent. When we take pictures of people or record their stories as NGOs, we're often capturing them at a time in their lives that's very difficult and in a set of circumstances that we hope will change quickly. They're in quite a vulnerable place and they might not want to be constantly reminded of that. And hopefully those circumstances won't last. So I think it's really important. And there's a lot of different points of view around this, but thinking about how long do you continue using those stories and images, and when do they become inaccurate and misleading actually as a representation of that person, and thinking particularly about kids and how quickly they change and how quickly their lives change. So you might want to think about setting a shorter lifespan for images featuring children.
These are really good points about making sure that people understand what consent means, and making sure that if you're not communicating in their language, that you're communicating it to them in a way that they feel empowered and have that ability to make decisions. The question I have for you, though, is about the administrative element of this. I have worked with organizations where it's like, okay, well, yeah, it was a big event. There were 100 people there. Everyone consented to having their picture taken because they were there. But how do you follow up with them to show them the final product? And how do you follow up with somebody if you want to use it in a different way? I mean, there is quite an administrative element to all of this. How do you track the consents along with the photos themselves? Because that seems to be the challenge when I'm advising organizations on image use is, but how are we going to track it? And I go, well, that's the trick. So what recommendations, kind of practical recommendations, do you have for that element?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that's often a weak point in the process, and it's probably one of the most logistically challenging bits. So I think when it comes to individuals, people who benefit from your project work, it's a little easier because often, I mean, I'm coming at this from the point of view of an organization that tends to be present in communities over a period of several years. And that's obviously a lot less true in emergency contexts. So making sure they are able to contact your staff and that your staff are also able to contact them. So whether it's a calling card that you leave behind or a tear-off strip at the bottom of your consent form, just thinking about how you can make it as easy as possible for them to get in touch and vice versa. But in terms of a sort of mass gathering, what you're talking about, like a conference, that is trickier. And I think it's something that's worth thinking through as you develop or review your consent policy. There are some really good examples. There's two guidelines I have in mind. One is for people in pictures, developed by Bond, and which I'll give you the link to for the show notes. And then Girls Not Brave, they have a really good set of guidelines too, developed by Jess Crombie. And in there, I think there's some quite detailed ideas around what you do in a sort of group setting. So it could be something like making sure that it's made very clear through posters or leaflets that the event's going to be recorded and that if people don't want to be featured, they know who they come and talk to. But you could also, and this is an idea I think Jess has come up with, is if people can be wearing stickers or have lanyards and that demonstrates that they don't want to be featured. And then also I think when it comes to showing people the end product, that's also a lot easier when you have a project team that's still present in the community and that is going back to visit people in their homes or their communities and gives an opportunity for that exchange to take place. In a mass gathering, I think it's probably more difficult, but I guess in that case, you could make sure that they follow your social channels or your website so that they can see the end result. And again, that they have the option of letting you know if there's anything that they object to. And I would just add that most of my work has an international dimension, but I think these lessons are not unique to international contexts. And in any interaction, when you're representing the giver of resources, there is a power imbalance there. And there's an opportunity for you to redress that imbalance by really centering the people benefiting from the project that you're running and asking them how they want to be portrayed.
I really like your idea about a sticker or a lanyard or something with a color on it to indicate to the photographers, right? Because the photographers aren't going to be able to necessarily keep track of everybody. So to indicate very clearly if somebody has consented or not consented, that's a really great idea for larger gatherings. But you're absolutely right. With these smaller, more intimate types of communications where you're maybe profiling somebody or profiling a family, then absolutely those are really good suggestions for ensuring that they get to see the final product, they get to see how they're being portrayed, and they are in agreement with it. Also, I really like the way that you aligned this with GDPR, because GDPR, which is the European Data Protection Law, is really just about empowering people to control their own information. And that's basically what you're describing with stories and images, is empowering people to control their own information and their own personal identity. So I think those are great analogies. Let me ask you this, though. Now, no one's going to come out and say, well, you know, I don't want to do ethical storytelling. I don't want to do ethical communications, right? No one in their mind is going to come out and say that. But some people might say, well, it's not as effective if we do this, that, and the other. Or, you know, if I can't use an image that is going to pull on somebody's heartstrings, it's not going to be as impactful. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, these are all arguments that I have heard regularly. And I think that underlying assumption that a story told ethically cannot be as powerful is a fallacy. And I think it's something that really holds us back. There is increasing evidence that people, supporters, will respond to stories that are told differently and stories that are surprising. And I think it's also worth thinking about this fact that we're not just trying to provoke pity in people. Coming back to the idea of poverty porn that you mentioned earlier, we want to move them in all kinds of different ways, and we want to give them a sense that change is possible and change is happening. And we know that's true because of the project work we do and the time we spend with people and communities. We see the change that they are driving and the agency and the ideas and the creativity that's already there. And sometimes we don't do such a good job of demonstrating that, I think, because we're so focused on demonstrating the needs that we're trying to address through our work. So I suppose that kind of zooming out and showing that broader picture of change and progress is really important, giving people that sense of possibility. You can move people in different ways. You can make them feel sad. You can make them feel inspired. You can make them laugh. And I think it's about, not to sound trite, but it's about showing that whole breadth of human experience and human emotion and trying to connect with people in different ways. And I think one thing that I have found in my work with Amrit in particular is that people do respond to those stories. And I think we also have to give our audiences credit. You know, they are also ready for change. And they're also feeling frustrated and perhaps a bit cynical about the charity sector, particularly internationally. And I think we need to give them the opportunity to respond to new stories rather than just assuming that they won't. So one particular example that I have in mind, and it's a small sample size, so it's important not to draw sweeping conclusion, but Amrit Health Africa did a piece of work a couple of years ago with Jess Conby again and David Gerling called Who Owned the Story? And it was a participatory photography project where we took four community health workers in Kibera, an informal settlement in Nairobi in Kenya. And we gave them a couple of days of training on the fundamentals of photography. And then they all had cameras and they went out into their communities and we asked them to document their lives and their work and the health challenges that the people they support are facing. And so they did that for a couple of days with support from a professional photographer. And then they came back and they looked at each other's work and they voted on which story they preferred. And then that story went out as a fundraising appeal to supporters of Amrit in the UK. And we A/B tested it. So we ran it concurrently with a more classic campaign that featured professional photography and was written in the voice of the UK CEO. So that more classic campaign went out and was sort of pitted against the kind of non-mediated appeal, which was written by a health worker called Patrick. All the pictures he had taken, he had decided on the layouts, he'd chosen the colours of the fonts. So he'd made all the sort of editorial decisions that normally would be made by Amrit. And his was the appeal that raised more money. So fewer people gave, but they gave significantly more to Patrick's appeal. And it was really interesting. We followed up with them. We did a survey of the people who had given to Patrick's appeal to ask them what it was that had inspired them. And I think it really was evident for me of how we sometimes as a sector can underestimate our supporters. People really enjoyed the fact that they perceived Patrick as an agent of change. His passion for his work shone through. He'd chosen to focus on older people and the challenges that they face in accessing healthcare. And that's something we probably don't talk about enough. And so it was a fresh story told through his eyes and in his words, and that people found really sort of invigorating. And people did talk about colonialism and paternalistic representations of Africa and how refreshing it was to see something different. So it's a small sample size and we need more projects like this. And I know there are lots of projects like this that are ongoing and underway, but I think it's an example possible. And equally thinking about that idea of process as well as end product, we went back and talked to Patrick and the other three community health workers to see how they had experienced it. And the feedback from them was also really positive. Kibera is one of the most photographed and most kind of recorded places in Africa and probably one of the most photographed informal settlements in the world. And I think they were really pleased to be able to tell the story of the place they live in their own words and sort of control how it's depicted after being sort of subjected to being photographed and talked about for such a long time.
That's a really great answer. And I'm fascinated by the story that you told, because not a lot of organizations would have gone through and done that A/B testing. And so you actually genuinely have these great data points to speak from authoritatively. I know you said the sample size was small, but I can't think of many other organizations that have gone through all of that. So that's a great example. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, we are a sector that loves to make data-driven decisions, and we should. We love evidence, but that's why we need more organizations to be doing these things and doing A/B testing, even on one channel, one campaign. Again, you don't need to revolutionize everything and you don't need to announce it either. So when we ran this project, our donors didn't know that this was what we were doing and we didn't sort of announce it. And it was only afterwards when we were doing the survey that we gave them that wider context. I'm a big fan of a sort of stealthy revolution and changing things without necessarily announcing it in advance. And then you've got, as you say, the evidence and the data that you can use to demonstrate that it's working, or at least that the sky isn't falling in.
Yeah, that's great. So because this is a podcast about risk, let's shift to talking a little bit about risk around ethical storytelling and communications. So risk is a two-sided coin. It's made up of threats and opportunities. So if somebody is listening today and they're saying, okay, I think this is something that I want to get into, or we should get into it as an organization, can you talk a little bit about the risks? What are the opportunities that they will come in contact with? And then what are some of the threats that they may face and need to overcome?
Yeah, great question. Once again, I think when we are careless with people's stories, we risk harming them, which contradicts and undermines our reason for being as social justice organizations that are supposed to put people first. And in the humanitarian sector, our kind of guiding principle is do no harm. And that should be true in our comms and fundraising in the same way that it's true in our program work. I think the biggest risk we run, we've already talked about how when it comes to making that shift in our storytelling and our fundraising, there's often a lot of nervousness around, well, what if it affects our bottom line? What if we raise less money? And I think that ultimately is a risk that we have to be willing to take, because the biggest risk we run is damaging the relationship we have with the people and communities that we serve. And once we've lost that trust, it's very hard to win it back. And that's why, for me, this area of work is a natural extension of our program work and should be governed by the same principles and treated with the same importance. You know, there's a safeguarding dimension to it too. And like you said, there's a parallel with GDPR. It's all about respecting people and showing them that we've earned their trust. And then I think, zooming out, there's a risk of inadvertently perpetuating stereotypes in the mind of our audiences, which has a ripple effect that we don't always realize or anticipate. I think as NGOs and charities, we maybe like to think that we don't have power. We're uncomfortable with the idea of having power, but we do have power. We have a sphere of influence individually, yes, but also collectively. As a sector, we have platforms, and with those platforms comes the power to shape perceptions of people and places. And when we publish something on our channels, the channels that we own, we're never doing it in a vacuum. We're contributing to a body of stories and information and knowledge that's already out there. And we can make the choice to perpetuate a stereotype, or we can make the choice to upend it. And there's increasing evidence that NGO communications and fundraising do have an impact in the real world in terms of how certain audiences see certain parts of the world, but then also how the people we depict, diaspora audiences, for example, view themselves. So we'll talk about resources and reading at the end, but I think there's a piece of work by Dr. Edward Adamolu, who is an academic in the UK. He's British Nigerian, and he's done some really interesting work around talking to the African diaspora in the UK and looking at how their perceptions of themselves and their communities and their countries of origin have been influenced and shaped by the communications that NGOs have been putting out through the decades. And he talks in particular about his own first visit to Nigeria as a child and how it was so different from what he was expecting, because he had grown up with these quite paternalistic depictions of the African continent. And those perceptions can lead to actions that are harmful. So I think it's really important not to underestimate that influence that we can have. And finally, I think the biggest mistake that you can make when it comes to ethical storytelling is thinking you know everything. But I think the second biggest is thinking you know nothing and that you have no power to change things, because then you don't try. And I really believe anyone can make a meaningful difference in this area. We all have different spheres of influence. We all have access to different decision-making processes or resource allocation processes or decision makers, people with influence. I think when it comes to unpacking decades-old ways of thinking and doing, then we all have a part to play. So thinking about who's in your sphere of influence and what they might need to feel confident making changes.
Those are great answers and great examples, Rachel. Thank you. I want to vibe a little bit off of what you were talking about with the last point there, where some people might think they don't know anything. So if somebody is listening today and they want to make a business case to their leadership or management and say, look, this is really something that we need to do, we need to focus on, we need to improve, how can they make a business case for additional resources or additional time or just a different approach? What is a really convincing case to be made to leadership that this is important and this is the right thing to do? How can they do that and maybe implement some change within their own organization?
I think, first of all, I would encourage them to take it seriously, as I said, as a kind of extension of the project work we do and the promise we make to people and the values that guide us as an organization. They should really spill over into our comms and fundraising. And I think also I would encourage them to focus on what you call the other side of the coin. So the opportunities and the creative possibilities that spring up when you come at things differently. I think I'd encourage them to see it as an opportunity for engagement and to really bind their communities together, their audiences around those shared values. And I think increasingly organizations that don't change in this way, you've already referred to DEI work, localization, decolonization and anti-racism. And I think comms and fundraising is quite fundamental to those broader shifts, and it can make a very meaningful contribution, or it can hold that broader work back. And I think increasingly organizations that aren't having these conversations and making meaningful commitment and allowing themselves to evolve and be held accountable are going to be left behind. And I think that has consequences for your organization in terms of how it's perceived by potential supporters. You know, supporters are really, they're smart and they're asking for more from us, and they should, but also potential employees. You know, people want to work for an organization that has the courage of its convictions, I think, and that is bold and brave, and that's recognizing what it might have done wrong or the harm it might have contributed to. And I think as a person who works in the sector, and particularly when it comes to comms and fundraising, you want to work for an organization that is bold and brave. And I also think, you know, even when it comes to talking about institutional donors and partners, those donors and partners are also keen to hear what we're doing when it comes to localization and decolonization and anti-racism. And I think, as I said, this is part of that. So actually, I think doing this work opens loads of doors to new audiences and new partners who might not have picked up on us, who might not have been on their radar previously. But really standing up for what we believe in, I think, can help us create these new communities that I think also not changing equally can close certain doors to us.
That's a great answer. And I like how you're focusing on not just the benefits can we get out of it, but also saying, look, donors are sophisticated. And we do know that there's competition in the market for the resources that are available, but donors are looking for organizations that are respectful as well as being bold. And I like that word, being bold. And I think that you can do this ethical communication and be successful and be bold and be respectful. It sounds like, I mean, what you're describing, Rachel, it makes a lot of sense. I want to ask a question now about board members. And I always ask this question on the podcast because I want my experts that I interview to help bring some advice and guidance to board members. So when we're dealing with nonprofits, a lot of times the board members are volunteers. They believe in the mission of the organization. Their heart is in the right place, but maybe they've never been on a board before, or maybe they're really self-conscious and they don't want to embarrass themselves in a board meeting, or maybe they're just really worried about harming the organization. And so they're a little bit nervous to take any steps. If you're advising board members, or if there's board members who are listening today, what can a board do to demonstrate its support for ethical communications? Are there questions that they can ask, data that they can request, individuals that can come and speak to them? How can a board really show that this is an important area and that they support it?
So this is a question that really made me think, and I think it's such an important one. The first thing I would love board members to ask is just very simply, how can we help? How can we ensure this is treated as seriously as it should be? How can we staff and resource it appropriately? I always appreciate it when people, especially people in positions of power, recognize the limits to their own expertise and trust those with a different area of expertise. And I think this is one of those themes where that really kind of comes into play. So you might not see the immediate need to make these changes, but I think, as you've already talked about, making a business case, I think being open to that and looking at all the opportunities it offers to become the kind of organization that you want to be. I think I always appreciate it too when people ask, what am I missing? What am I not understanding? When they're truly open to hearing about the work that you do in the broader context as well. I think that the context, those shifts that we are all trying to make at different paces. And then also, I think asking, how can I use my platform to further this agenda? So we've already talked about the fact that everyone has a sphere of influence, and often board members are quite influential people with really broad and diverse networks that they can use to kind of facilitate change within their organization. So I think that even in the way they communicate about the organization, so in the way they're posting on LinkedIn about a recent project visit or talking up the organization at a drinks reception, you know, every one of those interactions, I think, is an opportunity to do things differently and more ethically. And I think we all need to get into the habit of asking ourselves a certain set of questions. So things like, what story am I telling? Whose story am I telling? Who has ownership? Who has control? And why am I telling this story? Does it need to be told? Does it need to be told in this way? Am I centering myself? Is that helpful? And am I making sure that people are hearing directly from the people concerned? So I think there's a whole kind of checklist of questions that we all need to get into the habit of asking ourselves. And that extends to board members too. And I find in my experience has been that it can be really helpful for people to have a framework like that, something that they can kind of cling to and build all their comms around. And I think board members have a role to play there in facilitating the building of that framework and maybe bringing in an expert to help with the process and then making sure that it's used across the organization. And I guess where they can really have an impact too is by kind of modeling that good behavior, you know, right at the top. They're really influential within the organization. And I think them being seen to be making that commitment can really help that culture change that needs to happen.
I love how you started out with the question, how can I help? Because you know what? That's actually advice that I have heard from a lot of my guests to boards is starting with that one simple question. You're not the first person to say that one, Rachel. So how can I help? And then also modeling, like you were saying, modeling that behavior and keeping that checklist in mind and maybe asking when the new, I don't know, cover of the annual report is presented to them or when the new fundraising campaign is being developed, making sure that they're going through that checklist and they're asking those questions. What did we do around consent? What are we doing around approvals? What are we doing around engaging the people who we're featuring in these communications? So I think
that's great advice.
Yeah.
And if the answers to those questions are found to be or felt to be kind of unsatisfactory, well, we didn't ask the person how they wanted to be portrayed, or we didn't really take the time to have those kind of conversations, then why did we make those decisions? Were we under pressure? Were we working to timelines that were unrealistic and kind of artificial? You know, that artificial sense of urgency that I think we all suffer from and also are guilty of perpetuating. But I think board members have a role to play there as well.
Those are great points. Thank you, Rachel. So for folks who are listening today who are really interested in this area of ethical storytelling, ethical communications, and they want to learn more, what can you recommend? I know you had referenced a few things earlier, things that people can read, other podcasts they can listen to, online classes that they can take. Again, hopefully low to no expense, because the folks listening to the podcast are usually small to medium-sized, low to no resource organizations. So where can people go to read more and learn more about what you're talking about today, Rachel?
The one thing I would say is that from my work with Bond in particular, I often find it is the smaller, lower resource organizations that are being bolder and making changes, because in a way they have a bit more freedom, they have less bureaucracy and maybe fewer levels of approval. So I think it is more difficult for smaller lower resource organizations, but there are ways in which they are also a lot freer to change. So I think it's good to keep that in mind when you're feeling intimidated by everything that you see needs to be done. And I would say just, yeah, start small, start where you are and think about who is in your sphere of influence as an individual and also in your organization's sphere of influence. So in terms of resources that are out there, I think these conversations are getting more and more mainstream, more and more NGOs and charities are coming to understand the benefits of adopting more ethical approach. And as we said earlier, these conversations are taking place against a backdrop of societal shifts as well. So talking again about anti-racism, for example, but also thinking about our relationship with photography and our trust in imagery. So conversations around AI, for example, I think there's a lot of discussion out there in the Twitterverse and on the internet about our relationship and questions of ownership of image and representation. And those things can be quite helpful. But in terms of practical resources, there are, I've already mentioned, two guidelines that I think you can learn from, or perhaps even use as a model to develop your own guidelines, or use in place of your own guidelines while they're in process. So there's one developed by Bond, by the People in the Pictures Working Group. And if you're in the UK and your organisation is a member of Bond, then you can join the working group, which is a forum to encourage and facilitate best practice. And then there's also the guideline developed by Girls Not Brides, written by Jess Crombie, who's a person that you should definitely know in this space. And there's lots of really practical tools in that one too. So it's very accessible and immediately you can see how you might be able to implement it, I think, whatever size your organisation is. So in terms of research, there is the People in the Pictures, written for Save the Children by Jess Crombie and Siobhan Warrington. Who Owns the Story, which is the piece of work Amra contributed to, again by Jess Crombie and David Gerling. And then the work of Dr. Edward Adamolu, who works, I think, now at King's College in London. And he keeps producing really fascinating papers that you can read online that are open access. There's a couple of podcasts that I would really recommend. First of all, the Photo Ethic podcast. They haven't put out an episode for a while, but there's a big back catalogue that's really fascinating. And they had a really great range of guests, I would say, photographers, content producers, people who commission content, loads of different perspectives. And they really get quite gnarly. They go into a lot of detail about the ethics of imagery. So not specific to the NGO sector, but really applicable to our work. And then if you're interested in Africa and representations of Africa, there's a great podcast called It's Not a Continent. There's an organization called Fair Picture, which puts out lots of really useful resources recently around consent and also the decolonization of imagery in the INGO sector. They also run a lot of free accessible online events. And then, yeah, I think I would say just sort of keep looking out for representations of people and places that might expand your understanding. I feel like once you start looking, you see them everywhere. There's another book I would recommend called Africa is Not a Country by Deepal Faloyan, which deals a lot with representation in popular culture of Africa and African people. And there's a chapter there about INGO imagery, which is really good. A book called Photography, Race, Rights and Representation by Mark Seeley. And then another one I would recommend, one I read recently called How to Read Now by Elaine Castillo. It's about not just reading books, but reading all kinds of cultural artifacts as a kind of political act. So not for comfort, but to kind of fuel your fire. And she sort of objects to the idea that reading is this kind of cozy activity that encourages empathy. And she says it does, but it can be very political and it can help you become a more sort of active citizen, I guess. And I was recently reading it on the Northern Line. And anyone who has spent any time in London will know that the Northern Line is a kind of elaborate exercise in avoiding eye contact and protecting your personal space. But the lady next to me was like, I've been wanting to read that. How is it? And we chatted about it for about 10 minutes until she got off at her stop. So all that to say, there's no shortage of resources out there and a lot of them are free and a lot of them are maybe not specific to the INGO sector, but there are definite lessons that we can learn. And I think all of those can feed into the business cases that we are making, because I think it's really important to set our work within the context of broader changes in the sector and in society at large.
That's fantastic. What a great list of resources, Rachel. And I will make sure that we put all of the details in the show notes because you went through a number of them and I want to make sure people have access to them if they're interested in reading them. So thank you for that. Before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to add? Anything that we didn't cover or any parting words of wisdom for organizations that are trying to move more towards ethical storytelling?
Just two things. You made a really good point around photographers a while back. I think it's when we were talking about consent. So I'm just going to quickly revisit that. I think it's important to build them in as well. When we were talking about consent, there's a lot we can do to make sure that they are complying with our ethical guidelines, making sure you write it into the contract that you make for them. And so in the same way that you would expect them to align with your safeguarding policy, then you can also ask them to respect your ethical communication policy. And just, you know, having them be attuned to the time it will take to have those conversations around consent, for example, they can be a really powerful ally, and you can make sure that whole process that they are a key part of and is in line with your guidance. And that applies to any freelancers or creatives that you're commissioning. And the last thing I would say is don't be scared. I know it can be intimidating, but I think we really need everybody to be on board, and especially some of the bigger names who have real clout and set the bar for the rest of the sector. We need lots of organizations to be trying new things and then being open, sharing the results, because it's really important for us to have more and more examples of what's possible that help us chart a course for the future. And it's really important that we hold each other and ourselves accountable. I suppose the final thing I would say is that I think this work for me just makes us better organization, and it is tied to our broader missions and mandate. So I think in a way it's difficult. I know it's not difficult to argue with that because I've heard a lot of people arguing with that, but I think it can only be good for us as organization. It makes us more accountable to the people that we serve and support, and that's ultimately why we exist.
Oh, those are wonderful parting points, Rachel. Thank you so much. So if people who are listening today want to get in touch with you, if they have some more questions for you or want to follow up on a few things, what's the best way for people to get in touch?
That would be great. I love talking about this, as you can tell. But I also love listening. So they can find me on LinkedIn, Rachel Erskine. They can also find me on Twitter and Instagram, where my handle is Erskine Rachel. And yeah, if they'd like to send me a message, we can have a conversation over email or over a phone call. That would be great.
Wonderful. All right. So if people have any more questions or want to chat up with Rachel a little bit more, reach out to her. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Rachel. I have learned a lot, and I think this is such an interesting and also really inspirational topic. And I love the word that you used earlier, bold. I think that organizations need to be bold in this area, and I see many more opportunities than threats. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on this today.
Thank you for having me and for asking me such a smart and challenging question.
Great.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.